Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We continue our conversation with nuclear expert and whistleblower Paul Blanch about symptoms of decay within America's nuclear industry. Officials of that industry said they'd learn from the Fukushima Daiichi nightmare, but according to Paul Blanch, the underground coolant pipes at many of America's nuclear plants are decaying, and they're not being tested sufficiently.
Safety is third. Number one is making money. Number two is their public image, which is a big deal. And number three is maybe safety.
In Japan, TEPCO officials theorize that although Plant 4 was not operating before the earthquake and tsunami, it was nevertheless impacted by hydrogen traveling to it from an adjacent reactor through pipes and vents. Bloomberg is reporting that a radiation alarm was going off at Fukushima before the tsunami hit, which could mean that the plant was in fact damaged by the earthquake before the wave. TEPCO continues to pump water into plants 1, 2, and 3 in an effort to keep reactors cool now that cooling water containment has been breached, leading to a melting of rods. As of May 19th, TEPCO revealed that radioactive cesium-134 levels at Plant 3 are at 1,800 times the legal limit. Last week, cesium-134 levels were at 32,000 times the legal limit. These are the kinds of technical questions and dangers that would have been part of the job description for Paul Blanch, who spent some 27 years in the nuclear field working for major companies. He's now a whistleblower and expert on license renewal for New England nuclear plants. Last time, Paul Blanch told us the state's safety plan for Millstone Nuclear Power Plant, run by Dominion, isn't workable. In the event of a nuclear crisis at the plant, state DEP workers couldn't distribute potassium iodide or manage an evacuation in the event of an accident.
It's impossible to do, we know that, unless you're out in the middle of Kansas or something like that. You might be able to evacuate, but try to evacuate an area, including Long Island, 50 miles away, or actually much less, from Millstone, or worse yet, Pilgrim, or Indian Point. Impossible to evacuate even a 10-mile radius. But short of that, the biggest exposure initially is likely to come from iodide-131, and I think that the NRC has to bite the bullet, admit that the accident can happen, stockpile potassium iodide to those areas that could be impacted by the iodide-131, and make people aware of, if it happens, this is where you go quickly to get this stuff.
Which, of course, also begs the question, should it be distributed? State DEP nuclear expert Dr. Wild spoke of a 10-mile radius where it's already being made available, but I wonder how many people, first of all, know about it, and second of all, know the instructional on when to take it, how to administer it to your kids, and so on. And then, too, you know, after Fukushima, a lot of Americans found out that the available potassium iodide had been distributed to Japan. So if they had gone on to the website like we did of the Food and Drug Administration to find the distributors for this stuff, they would have learned that they were out of stock. These are the realities that develop after an incident.
And these are the realities. And all of a sudden it becomes non-available. And I went on to eBay and I saw people selling potassium iodide for $4,000 a dose. Talk about capitalism. It's not available. And what the government needs to do is to get out there and rather than having their PR people cover up all these events that occur, to have their PR people saying, hey, an event could occur. If it does occur, this is what you do. We have X number of doses of potassium iodide. When the event occurs, we want people to come to wherever those distribution centers are. They will receive instructions on when to take it, how much to take, how long to take it, what's the dosage, and so on and so forth. But that would be an admission by the industry that an accident is possible, a significant accident is possible, and the industry doesn't want to admit to that possibility.
Well, is nuclear power truly emission-free? And I ask that because I've noticed that at the end of NPR news broadcasts lately, we've heard them thank Dominion for providing their funding. They say, you know, Dominion, operating Millstone, powering 1,100 jobs and providing emission-free energy to the state of Connecticut. So is that true? And if it's not true, what about the testing and monitoring for radiation that we have now for Millstone and other plants in New England?
I was responsible at Millstone for the radiation monitoring. There is a small amount of radiation released from Millstone, small amount from, you know, all these plants during normal operation. And I want to be very frank that in my opinion, and I'm not an anti-nuke, but the amount of radioactive material being released from these plants during normal operation is not harmful to the general public. Probably not what you wanted to hear, but the amount of radiation under normal operations is insignificant. We've seen up in Vermont significant releases of tritium to the groundwater. Tritium's a somewhat different isotope. Actually, it's a hydrogen isotope. It's part of water. It's an indication. It certainly, if you drink enough of it, yes, you're going to get overexposed, but most of the tritium has remained on site, and then some of it has gotten into the Connecticut River up at Vermont Yankee. But as one reporter from the papers up there asked me, how dangerous is it? And I said, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, probably not much worse than smoking a pack or two of cigarettes per day. But realistically, the thing that bothers me about tritium being released at Vermont Yankee and at Indian Point, which has been significant, is it's indicative of other problems. It's the smoke where there is a fire. It's indicative that it is leaking from corroded pipes, and we have seen instances of corroded pipes both at Vermont Yankee, at Pilgrim, and especially at Indian Point, that these pipes are corroding away, and it's irresponsible by our government to allow these plants a 20-year life extension without a program to ascertain that these pipes are maintaining their integrity and not corroding away. And we have much, much evidence that proves otherwise, both, well, at Indian Point and then in New Jersey, a very significant issue of corroded pipe there, and, you know, vital pipe that is necessary for core cooling. We have seen it out in Illinois. We have seen it on a lot of plants. Almost every plant has significant corroded pipe, and I think that without a program to inspect this corroded pipe that's buried underground to allow these plants to continue for an additional 20 years without an adequate program to ascertain the integrity of these pipes is irresponsible. You know, all these plants are saying, we will monitor corroded pipe, and the NRC uses these words, every opportunistic period. Well, what does opportunistic mean? It means when the water starts coming up and the pipe fails, then we will monitor the thickness of the pipe. I mean, you talk about playing word games, and we can see it in the Indian Point application, Pilgrim application, see it on and on. These are the industry words, opportunistic inspections. To me, that means run it till it fails. An opportunistic inspection on a car, fan belt, or braking system is, well, we'll look at the hydraulic hoses after they fail. There is no inspection prior to failure, and that's one of the big difficulties I have with the NRC, and, you know, I'm certainly dealing with relatively high levels. And the same applies to the gas lines across Indian Point. There's no requirement for inspection of those gas lines, and you know, I'm working with Congressman Markey on some of these issues, and a few other congressmen around the area. I've certainly worked with Peter Welsh in Vermont, and I've worked with Peter Shumlin, the governor of Vermont, and had discussions with the attorney general for Massachusetts, and it's not a comfortable situation right now, the way we're not being regulated.
Is it radioactive or not, the tritium?
Tritium is radioactive, yes.
Okay. And so I'm going to assume that when it's part of the cooling, that means cooling water flows through the pipes and somehow tritium's getting out. So that would mean, ostensibly, I guess, that other particles could eventually get out too, right?
Yeah, but you got to realize that the tritium is coming primarily from the pipes that are underground, buried pipes. And it's contaminating the groundwater. And a little known fact is that Millstone also has a tritium problem. Some 75% of the nuclear power plants have tritium leaking into the groundwater. Tritium normally does not become airborne. It's water. So it stays in the ground. Now, you say if tritium is coming out, there's got to be other elements coming out. That's not necessarily an accurate statement. Tritium is created in the water that cools the reactor through neutron irradiation. So it's primarily the primary radioactive material in the water that goes through the reactor. I say primary, there are other things, is tritium. So when you get a leak in a pipe, what leaks out is primarily tritium. There can be other isotopes. There can be some strontium, but very, very insignificant amounts. But right now, when you have a leak in the pipe, especially at a boiling water reactor, the first indication you get is tritium. That's under normal operation, not accident condition.
Are there emissions when maintenance operations are going on? I mean, do they ever, you know, recycle a plant where, let's say, some of the storage is at plant one, where they have to, you know, get rid of some water and replace it? Or are there any operations like that during which there are releases?
Oh, there are releases. And those releases are well below the allowable limits. And anything that is released under normal operations from any of these nuclear power plants, and I think you can take this to the bank, is that they're well below limits that are specified either by the NRC or the International Council on Radiation Protection. And I don't think during normal operations, any harmful amounts of harmful radioactive material are being released from these plants. Now, there's going to be disagreement between what I just said and anti-nuclear groups and things like that, who will claim that, you know, any amount of radiation is going to do some harm. But during normal operations, these amount of releases are insignificant and not harmful. It's just during the abnormal occurrences and the accident situations where we get radiation that would be harmful to the general population.
Have emissions under unusual circumstances ever exceeded that level that is being said to be safe?
During normal operations, no. During upset conditions, the answer is yes. I mean, we have seen reports, and you could do some research on the NRC website, where we discharged a tank and our radiation monitor wasn't calibrated properly, and we exceeded the concentration allowed by, it's called 10 CFR Part 20, which is radiation limits or radioactive material limits. Periodically, it does occur. It has occurred when Kinetic Yankee was in operation. We had, in the year 2000, an accident at Indian Point where they released radioactive material to the environment that exceeded the NRC EPA allowable value. So when there are upset conditions or accident conditions, yes, it has happened. And one can go through various NRC reports, and mishaps do occur, and once in a while, radiation is released that will exceed the limits set by the NRC, and the NRC will say, you were a bad boy, don't do it again, and promise you won't do it again. They won't impose any sanctions on them or impose any fines or anything like that. They'll just make them promise they'll be good boys in the future.
Well, that brings me to the question of the nuclear site that is closest to where I produce my radio show in Storrs, Connecticut, near the University of Connecticut. And my question at our studios, we're close enough to Millstone to be worried about taking potassium iodine should there be an event there and a release. And so we wondered, is there like a something you can tell us about life, let's say within 5 or 10 or 20 miles or 50 miles, if you're getting these periodic or small low-level releases on a regular basis for, let's say, your whole lifetime, maybe 70, 80 years, can it have a cumulative effect? And if so, isn't that negative on your health?
Realistically, the releases are so small. I mean, everything has a risk to it. I mean, if I'm driving along following a diesel truck, you know, I inhale something that is not good for me. I don't think that there are significant health dangers by anything that's released under normal operations from these plants, including some of those inadvertent releases where they might exceed the limit by just a little bit. Truthfully, the significance is minimal.
So what we're dealing with then is the risk posed by the location of these plants in terms of what's going on there that could go terribly wrong if an event occurs. And in that sense, I mean, I guess the final thought I have here is still, again, based on the meeting that we did have with Dr. Edward Wilds of the state DEP. He's their nuclear radiation expert there. And, you know, he was asked to talk about this question of testing that's going on to determine the stability of aging nuclear facilities in the United States. And apparently there are a number of test dates where these plants will be evaluated over the course of the next few years, we would imagine. And at the same time, there's discussion about building new plants. So one wonders if there's ever going to be a moment where we stop and fully evaluate what we're doing with building any new plants and actually do what the industry says we should do. You know, they themselves say, well, we're going to learn from this and do better next time. But how can they if they're going ahead with plans already made long before Fukushima happened? And we have no real way of knowing what's been factored in as far as safety precautions, do we? And besides,
yeah, we don't. And, I've been in communication with some congressional offices and NRC people. And it's a pretty rash statement that I'm going to make, but NRC people have essentially been told, we don't want you to find out anything that's going to cause any major problems and economic impact on these nuclear power plants. And that's heard firsthand from NRC people who, you know, come to me and come to Dave Lockbaum and other people similar to that. And I've worked with Markey, and I've actually got a letter that Markey wrote on April 15th addressing that issue that I brought to Markey's office. And it says, we understand the inspectors have been told to do a quick inspection by April 29th, which is past us. You're allowed 40 hours for a single plant. If it's a dual plant like Millstone or Indian Point, you're allowed a whole 50 hours to expend on that. And you can't do anything as far as identifying potential risky areas in 40 or 50 hours. And I could actually send you that letter that I assisted Markey in producing on April 15th.
We'd be glad to see that. And we'd also be very happy to go over the details with you again on that as they unfold, because I think that is going to become a significant question as the Obama administration frees up in excess of $36 billion in loan guarantees for the nuclear industry. They're going to want to take that money before anyone has a chance at limiting it or regulating it, right?
Right.
So again, we come back to where we started, that this is largely dictated by the money involved. Whether you're talking about profits at a plant like Millstone, which at one time, you know, was shut down, the state wondering if it would ever operate again.
I was part of that.
And can we just talk about that as we close here? Because I think a lot of people living in the state of Connecticut don't know that history. And so when I interviewed the spokesperson for Dominion, but also specifically for the Millstone site, you know, he indicated that there were not any safety problems at the plant, but really it came down to money. They decided, and he indicated it was the state that made the decision, that it wasn't cost effective to start plant one up again, but that it had nothing to do with safety, he said.
Yeah, I happened to be part of that decision at the time, which was 1995-96 time frame. I was actually reporting to the chief nuclear officer. And if you remember, I mentioned to you that the NRC does not fully understand which regulations are applicable to any plant. So in 1996, I believe it was, Dr. Shirley Jackson, who was chairman of the NRC at the time, demanded that Millstone, because it was all shut down primarily, well, I had a lot of input into that, and I was rehired for political reasons, demanded that Millstone, units 1, 2, and 3, number one, identify all the regulations that are applicable to those plants. Now, you've got to recognize that Millstone 1 was the oldest plant brought online in 1971. We started looking through the regulations that are applicable and what it would take to demonstrate that plant in 1997 was in compliance with the requirements that it was initially licensed to in 1971. And it was determined, in order to bring that plant up to the requirements to which it was licensed in 1971, would not be cost-effective to do. It would cost over, I'll throw a number out, it would cost more than $1 billion or more than $500 million to go through and ascertain that that plant would be in compliance with the regulations. Decision was made, okay, to satisfy the NRC, because Shirley Jackson, who was a wonderful lady, still is, that it was not cost effective. We cannot afford to put $1 billion into this plant because the price of electricity and the cost of oil was down, and we couldn't sell enough electricity over the remaining life of that plant to make $1 billion investment reasonable. So decision on Millstone 1 and Connecticut Yankee basically was made, and Maine Yankee and Yankee Row. It wasn't worth it. So we're not going to invest in that. Now, Unit 2 and Unit 3 at Millstone were newer plants, and we spent over $1 billion on Units 2 and 3 to demonstrate compliance with the regulations. That was cost-effective. There were bigger plants. There were newer plants, so it was easier to do. It only cost $1 billion to do. So economics drive everything. Safety is secondary. The number one item in, I don't care what business it is, but especially in the nuclear industry, is money is the most important concern they have, making money. They say safety first. Safety is third. Number one is making money. Number two is their public image, which is a big deal. And number three is maybe safety, but only as it affects number one and two.
And we are, of course, speaking with Paul Blanch, who is a whistleblower on some of these plants after having worked in these industries for many years. Can you just be more specific? I know it's a lot to ask, but in other words, when the question was raised about needed changes to the plant to bring it up to regulation, the reason they couldn't operate it until they did that had to do with safety, right?
Basically, that is correct. Now, Congress determined that if a plant is operated in accordance with the regulations, it is safe. If it is not operated in accordance with the regulation, it is not safe. Now, that's what the NRC premise is, and that's what congressional premise is. The plant was not operating in compliance with the regulations, so by definition, it was unsafe.
We have interviewed others on this topic, and what they've said, too, is that because of the way the industry has worked with Congress for many years, taxpayers have to bear the burden of risk, because if anything does go wrong, we have exposure to cover the costs of dealing with those crises, just as now we're looking at Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese people, in fact, are bailing out TEPCO. They're buying TEPCO stock and recapitalizing the business so that they don't go under.
That's a very, very accurate prophetic statement that we have Price Anderson that covers up to $13 billion. After that, let's assume that we had an accident at Indian Point, and some people are projecting a cost not of $13 billion. We've seen projections in Japan of $300 billion. An Indian Point accident that contaminates a lot of land, primarily the water supplies and infrastructure of New York City. Some people have said $1 trillion or more dollars. That cost is going to be borne by the taxpayer. These companies do not, just like TEPCO, have $1 billion to compensate the people for their damage. So if there's any compensation, which there may be some, but it might be pennies on the dollar, will come from the government. But people will, if I have a $10 million house in Westchester County, I'm not going to get $10 million for that. There won't be any demand for it. It'll be pennies on the dollar that I will be compensated, even if I have to abandon that house. Any compensation, well, small amount will come from Price Anderson, but that's a trivial amount. The second funds will come from the government. And all of these companies like Entergy have conveniently formed limited liability corporations like Vermont Yankee Nuclear is a limited liability corporation. They have assets maybe of $2 or $3 billion, so their exposure is $2 or $3 billion. The entire corporation of Entergy or Dominion or whatever other nuclear company, their assets are not exposed. Because they have conveniently formed, with the NRC's endorsement, limited liability corporations. Indian Point is operated by a limited liability corporation, so their liabilities are very, very small. They cannot go after Entergy, big corporate umbrella. They can only go after that limited liability corporation, which is an issue most people don't really understand what is going on, but these companies are all forming these LLCs that do exactly what they're designed to do, protect their shareholders.
Paul Blanch, I know that groups in Connecticut like PACE, People's Action for Clean Energy, or the Sierra Club are really looking for this kind of information. So thank you very much for coming on the show, and we'd like to have you back again to talk about all of this.
I am available, and I appreciate your time, Dory.
Paul Blanch is a veteran of the U.S. Nuclear Navy. He spent a total of 40 years in the nuclear industry and serves as a safety consultant and expert witness, as well as being a whistleblower about nuclear safety. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. Our website is talknationradio.org. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com.